The next case on the calendar is Pharisee Law Firm versus API Inc. Asbestos Settlement Trust. We are being joined by Judge Conley, instead stepping in for Judge Rathbold. The case number is A19-0846, and I know that counsel are familiar with the Minnesota Court of Appeals, but a welcome. You'll each have 15 minutes with 5 minutes for rebuttal. And state your name when you begin so that we can have that on the record. The podium goes up and down, and are you ready to begin?
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you.
May it please the court, counsel, John Pharisee appearing for and on behalf of the Pharisee Law Firm, PA. The firm is before this court today to respectfully request that it be afforded the fee which it deserves to be paid and has earned in this, in the underlying claim against the home liquidator. Timing of termination is an especially crucial factor in determining a fee for a contingency fee lawyer, especially when that timing of termination occurs mere weeks before the settlement. And the court below has determined that prior to our firm's final determination, we and the trustee, our client, worked together to set the stage for an excellent outcome consistent with the settlement objective identified entering into the settlement negotiations. Millions of dollars were received, and as the court stated, there's the possibility of more in the future. It is undisputed that Pharisee originated, developed, and successfully deployed the claim strategy that produced the recovery.
Mr. Pharisee, on that factor, the court, would you agree first that the court did consider that factor among, together with the other seven, but specific, and assuming you agree with that, the court did, what specific factual finding to that factor did the court err in making?
Well, the court listed it as a factor. I don't think they considered it the way that the Supreme Court wanted it to be considered. The court said that apparently my understanding of the court's view is that the reason that the firm was terminated was because of long-term dissatisfaction with the firm's handling of the home liquidator case. And there's really no facts that support that finding. In fact, it's contrary to the findings that we did excellent work and obtained the settlement even prior to our, that allowed the settlement to be obtained even prior to our final termination. So I think that the court looked at it as some sort of what was in the head of the advisor, special advisor to the trust, and the future claimant's representative at the trust. That's not the trust. The trustee is run by the trust. The special advisor and
I'd like to. You say there's absolutely no evidence in the record to support the dissatisfaction. I'm looking at respondent's brief, page 9, where they quote that same day Mr. Pope wrote to Mr. Brownson and Judge Carey and stated, you know, as a lifelong contingency fee lawyer, the last thing I would even wish to do is deny a contingency fee to a lawyer who has taken a risk, put in blood, sweat, and tears into a case and bring it to a conclusion. That is not the situation here. Ferry has done, and you know, I'm sure you're familiar with the rest of the email. I mean, is that not? I mean, I can understand you disagree with that, but that's some evidence in the record, isn't it?
I don't think it is, because it's not coming from the trust. It's coming from a third party at the who has a relationship with the trust, but is not the trust. Secondly, what Mr. Polk says is not.
Are there any emails back that said you're absolutely wrong?
There's no response at all saying whether he's right or wrong from the trust.
Well,
but the trust does not take
that. They did fire you, right?
They fired me weeks before the settlement.
Wouldn't that be some evidence that they agreed with, that they were dissatisfied with your representation?
I don't see how it could be. They fired me at the last, fired us at the last minute.
I'm not so much focusing on the timing as to whether or not there's evidence in the record of dissatisfaction. And you're saying that isn't any evidence because no one on the other side agreed. And I'm suggesting, well, based on that email, perhaps that's why they, that does express dissatisfaction. So why am I wrong on that? Perhaps I am.
Well, I think that Mr. Polk is wrong because he accuses us of not doing anything on the claim, and we clearly did. We spoke to the liquidator. They refused to discuss the operations, the non-aggregated operations claim issue with us. I drafted a very strong letter to the liquidator. I discussed it with the trustee. We decided not to send it because we thought it might be harmful to our future settlement positions. So this whole idea that we didn't do anything is wrong. We decided not to do anything and wait until the Western Asbestos Settlement Trust, the 800-pound gorilla of the liquidation, settled their claim. No one ever told me they were dissatisfied. And if they were dissatisfied, and this was sent months before we were terminated and rehired, why did they rehire us if they were dissatisfied with our job? Why would they terminate us just weeks before the settlement when they've accepted our advice and done what we told them to do? We are the experts on this issue, and the court found that. We know much more about this issue than the trustee did, and in fact, the trustee has made several statements, including that this issue was resolved in the 1980s, calling it completed operations coverage when it is operations coverage that is non-aggregated, and showed in the negotiations a basic lack of understanding of what a non-aggregated operations coverage is. So I think there's no basis for any dissatisfaction. I think the accusations contained in this paragraph on page 9 of the respondent's briefs are palpably false. They're just not true. And I think that's, and that's, they kept us for a reason. We were their lawyers for a reason. We were chosen. This is our specialty. This is a claim that we fully developed in conjunction with the home liquidator claim, and the court found that we fully developed the home liquidator claim working on the Zurich matter, which...
The Zurich matter was... Judge Thunheim dismissed the case.
Correct.
As I understand it, under Rule 12.
No, it's a motion for summary judgment.
Motion for summary judgment. You appealed.
Yes.
And presumably you were asking for a whole lot more money prior to the dismissal than the $200,000 settlement that was reached to dismiss the appeal.
I'm not sure there's much in the way of the settlement negotiations prior to the summary judgment motion, but yes, certainly we were looking for more money than that.
Because you were looking for millions and millions of dollars, as I read the record.
Absolutely.
In all these other cases.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And you were paid for Zurich.
We were paid one-third of a $200,000 recovery.
And you worked 2004 47 hours in Zurich.
My associate did. I did not, like most if not all plaintiff's lawyers, I did not keep track of my hours, but I did work full-time for years on those trust matters.
And then presumably if you're saying it's your associate's hours that are reflected in the 2,000-some hours in Zurich, then it was at your associate's hours that are reflected in the Atlantic Mutual case of 1,500.
That is correct,
okay.
Your Honor. And there's overlap between and among all these cases. We represented before and after the trust was created. We represent the insurance asset, essentially, and it's our job to maximize that asset. And it's important to remember that the Zurich case, summary judgment was entered on the basis of our successorship claim. There was no decision one way or another on the completed operations claim. But it was heavily litigated in the Zurich matter, and that's why the court said that we fully developed the case against the home liquidator in the Zurich case. And that the Supreme Court said you're supposed to consider the hours that went into the claim. Here, those thousands of hours and the years that I spent from my life and professional career on that case transferred over to the home liquidator matter. So there's no double compensation here. It's just a matter of one party having more fault than the other. Here, that party was the home liquidator. And I'd also note that the lower court found, and I appreciate its findings that we did an excellent job. I appreciate its findings that we have an outstanding reputation.
But you'd rather have the money.
Well, I think good lawyers get paid, Your Honor.
No, I agree. I'd rather have the money, too.
Yeah.
I think that speaks volumes as to whether you're doing a good job. You know, show me the money. So.
Right. Absolutely. As I said earlier, we think we've earned and deserve that money. We came up, originated, developed, and successfully deployed this claim strategy that got the home liquidators, the home liquidator to agree to pay up to $21.5 million. And it was fully developed as part of the claim against Zurich. We're entitled to...
Mr. Farrisee, would you agree, and I'm looking at, again, the eighth factor, the timing, and it's Roman numeral 7, the court finds that the timing of the termination when combined with the other factors, which the court had previously gone through, does not warrant an extreme fee value approximating a contingent fee. And it seems like you are indeed asking it a couple different times in your brief, a correlation pretty much supplying the contingency fee. Would that be a correct statement, at least first off in the law the court did make, that once the termination of the contract occurred, contingency fee is off the table and the quantum merit is what we are to look at, and that's why these eight factors were developed?
Well, quantum merit and contingency fees are not mutually exclusive. It's not like by going to quantum merit they get an automatic discount. On the contrary, the Minnesota Supreme Court held in this case that you cannot reduce the contingency fee by firing the lawyer. You can't, at the last minute, you can't.
What language in the Supreme Court's opinion would I look to support the position you're just taking?
Just a moment.
I mean, would it be the language in...
It's the especially crucial language.
Sure. I mean, is this the language? Because we have clarified that the calculation of a quantum merit award includes considering the fee arrangement existing between counsel and client, we agree with the Court of Appeals that a remand is necessary so the district court may consider the contingent fee agreement between Farrisee and API Trust in addition to the other relevant factors we have identified. Is that the language I should be focusing on?
No, I'm just about to find it, Your Honor.
Okay. Well, I don't want to take any more time. Maybe you can look for it in rebuttal. So I don't want to, you know, spin the clock out for you.
The court has to measure the value of services depending on how the timing of the termination related to the ultimate result. Here we have a finding that prior to our final termination, we had set the table. We had the settlement ready to go. And then it says here that to demonstrate with extreme examples, the value conferred could vary if the client discharges the attorney after one day of representation compared to moments before the settlement occurs. Considering the timing of the termination is especially crucial to prevent a client from avoiding a contingency fee when it becomes apparent that the client will recover or reach a successful result. It was apparent at the time that we were fired that the client would recover. There was $11 million on the table, for one thing. I had sent them a memo outlining how to proceed with the negotiations and reviewing the bidding, and we were well on our way to reaching a settlement, and that's consistent with the findings and supported by the findings of the district court. Thank you.
Thank you. You'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please court, counsel, Justin Weinberg appearing on behalf of the API Settlement Trust. The rule in the language from the Supreme Court is they're citing to the Lawler rule, which has been the rule for over 100 years in this state, that the rule prevents a contingent fee attorney from recovering the contingent fee under the terms of the contract if the contingency occurred after the client terminated the attorney's representation. Instead, the discharged attorney is entitled to compensation for the reasonable value of the services under the equitable theory of quantum merit. What that means is, and the Supreme Court is not saying that we just disregard that a contingency fee arrangement was entered into between the client and the attorney, the discharged attorney. But what the Supreme Court said in the case last year was reaffirming what they've been saying for over 100 years. You don't get the contingency fee. When the court comes up with a quantum merit award, it cannot be based on the contingency fee. But you have to consider that, in fact, there was a fee arrangement to include a contingency fee arrangement when you come up with reasonable value. And that makes sense, because maybe it's a blended rate. So that's why the Supreme Court is telling district courts, take that into consideration. Maybe they already received X number of dollars throughout this. So when we're going to determine the reasonable value, we have to consider that as well. So we're not saying that you disregard the fact that a contingency fee agreement was in place, but under no circumstance can the award be the contingency fee. And the Supreme Court made that clear. Yet we are here again.
Mr. Weinberg, can I just ask, though, in the Supreme Court, the concern and added that factor, of course, the timing of the termination. Is it not true that akin to here, at least, shall we say, where the termination happens so soon prior to and arguably before, depending on the facts, to a settlement, at least on its face, the implication being that that could encourage not only in this case but future cases to terminate right towards the end. And so that's why the court added that factor. And would not the contingency itself, would it be inconsistent with that decision if the facts are right that, in fact, the dollar amount that equals under quantum merit what the contingency would be would still be consistent if all those eight factors are looked at, and we're focusing on number, I think it's seven or eight factor at the timing.
Correct. So a couple of points to that. One, the Supreme Court did not say that factor is especially crucial. What the Supreme Court said in its ruling is it said when we have two extreme examples, one, the discharged attorney is fired after one day of doing some work, or two, after the contingency is effectively satisfied. And that's the Stoneman case where the attorney went out to California, they did the mediation, and we had the perfunctory just signing of the mediated settlement agreement, and the client fired the attorney on the way home. Those two extreme examples. We don't have that here. And so that's why it's not, timing has to be weighed with all other factors. Here, and as the district court found in the record, at the time of the discharge, they were $28 million apart. After the discharge, the home liquidator stated, we are at an impasse. Those are not words and facts that support a settlement was absolutely imminent, or frankly, it was already done, for that especially crucial component to come in for the Supreme Court. What they wanted to prevent was the Stoneman factor, and saying that when everything is done, then it's going to justify a higher fee. But it still doesn't justify the contingency fee. And the Supreme Court made that part very clear. So we don't have those extremes in this particular case. In addition, what we have to, and it's clear, and we need to keep sight of this, was the district court clearly erroneous in its findings? And did they abuse, did the district court abuse its discretion? And under all eight factors, you don't even hear the argument from the appellant that there was a clear abuse of discretion. They don't, the appellant does not like the fee. To be perfectly frank, I don't like the fee. I think it should have been less. And we told the district court that. But at the end of the day, we can respect it, and
well,
we're not
filing
clearly
that argument appeal. Didn't work, because that's why we're here and why the Supreme Court reversed. They didn't like zero either.
They didn't like zero either, correct. When we weigh all eight factors, and we go through all eight factors as the district court did, we can't find a clear abuse of discretion or that it's clearly erroneous. The Farrisee Law Firm had the opportunity to reopen the record. It chose not to do that. Both parties said keep the record closed. And so the district court took that record that was before it and made very detailed findings to support its award. Some of those factors weighed in favor of a higher fee, some of those factors were neutral, and some of those factors weighed against a high fee. When we go through the factors, and again, this is important, and this comes under the time and labor required, we have to focus on the post-January 2009 work that was done. The district court said that in 2016, this court said that in 2017, the Supreme Court said that last year, and the district court said it again. An attorney is not entitled to double payment. So we have to focus all of our efforts on the post-2009 work to the home liquidator case, not the Zurich case, not the Atlantic Mutual case. And when we do that, Farrisee admitted at the Supreme Court that there was minimal time spent, maybe 10 hours, on the home liquidator case. It's cited by the district court. It's cited again by us. So in coming up with that finding, the district court had no other choice really than to take Farrisee at its word that it spent approximately 10 hours on this claim, which doesn't justify a very, very large award. Nature and difficulty. Again, the district court.
Just to be clear, so the 10 hours, I was trying to find out where did that come for the record. So that was, you're saying, a concession that Mr. Farrisee made when he was arguing at the Supreme Court.
Correct.
In response to some question, I assume.
Correct.
Okay.
And made that admission on the record. And again, that was the record before the court. And even at the district court, the first time stated it was minimal time spent. So there's that piece, and it wasn't just 10 hours. On nature and the difficulty, the district court actually made a benevolent finding for Farrisee in saying this is a very complicated case for asbestos product liability. But Farrisee, again, in down at the district court, stated that this is a really simple matter of negotiation. It was no different than a car accident or other cases. Arguing against themselves, but the district court made that finding in favor of Farrisee, and there is nothing clearly erroneous about that finding. The amount involved and the results, again, a finding in favor of Farrisee that there was a substantial contribution to the size of the settlement ultimately achieved when Farrisee was on this particular case. which it favored an award of the fee. For the fees customarily charged, the district court did its best to find weigh that factor. When Pharisee offered no evidence on this, no evidence as to what the customary fees are charged, talked about fees that were received in other cases that the Pharisee firm worked on, but the district court was left to do a patchwork based on some testimony here and there and other exhibits to come up with what were the fees that were customarily charged for matters like this. And what they really had is they had really good evidence of what the trustee charged, which was $300 per hour. So again, when left with the record before it, the district court did the best job it can.
So there was no expert testimony on either side?
None. Okay. Pharisee did not offer any. And again, it's important to note that the Pharisee firm had the opportunity to reopen the record and chose not to do that. The experience and reputation and ability, there's findings on both sides that both Pharisee and Mr. Brownson had the experience, had the reputation, had the ability to do this. There's no abuse of the discretion, nor is it clearly erroneous. And again, found that Pharisee had more experience in this area than Mr. Brownson did. We may not agree with that, but it's not clearly erroneous, and it does not rise to the level of a reversal. Again, as for the fee arrangement, and we talked about this, the district court made specific findings on this and said there was a contingency fee arrangement between the two parties. But when I weigh all of the factors, and I'm not going to base the award on hours, and I'm not going to base the award on the contingency fee, I'm going to weigh all eight factors, and that's how the court ended up coming up with $84,000. It's not based just on hours. It's not based just on the contingency fee. Why? Because the Supreme Court was clear that the courts should not do that going forward. Don't use just hours, and you most certainly cannot base it on the contingency fee itself. You have to come to a quantum merit award using these eight factors. On the contribution of hours, it's important to note that the finding, again, is that Mr. Brownson took the laboring oar. And that's a specific finding that the district court made and did most of the work. And at the time of the termination, there was no guarantee of settlement because they were $28 million apart. And there was an impasse. So Brownson's contribution was substantial and pivotal. And that's a finding that the district court made to the ultimate settlement after the termination was made. That factor weighed in favor of a smaller award. And again, there's nothing erroneous about that finding when you consider the record that was before the district court.
Mr. Weinberg, I have a question. Let's assume that the district court issued the exact same order with one difference. Instead of $84,000, the number is $3 million. Otherwise, the analysis is identical. Would that analysis presented support that number, too?
I'm not certain that it would when you consider, one, the contribution of others and that another attorney and the client did most of the work. When you consider the timing of the, which I'll get to on the termination itself, and when you consider the actual time required and the time put in, I don't know how you can justify a $3 million award when somebody puts in admittedly 10 hours of work on a particular matter to get to a quantum merit for reasonable value, and it has to be a reasonable fee. In this instance, the award was twice the amount that Brownson charged when Brownson took the laboring oar on all of this. So I think that that factor, frankly, does weigh in favor of Pharisee when you consider the award as opposed to the finding. On that termination piece of it, the trust was dissatisfied with the legal services. It was dissatisfied, and there was evidence going all the way back to 2011. And the trust is run by the trustee, Mr. Brownson, but also includes the trust advisor and the legal representative, which included Judge Carey and Michael Polk at the time. And there was emails and testimony at the hearing about their dissatisfaction. The district court specifically found that it was not, the determination was not to avoid a fee, especially when you consider how far apart these parties were at the time, in the time of termination. And we cannot forget that Farisee was terminated first in May of 2012 and was brought back to resolve the Zurich case because they were zeroed out at that point. But Farisee came back, was able to achieve a $200,000 settlement, and was paid for that work, and was paid a contingency fee based on that $200,000. The record and the findings by the court went to great lengths on this particular finding, and again, it's not the only factor that should be weighed. When we review the record before the district court, we review the record before this court, and all of the findings that were made, there is nothing clearly erroneous, and there was no abuse of discretion by the district court. And it supports an affirmance of the district court based on the longstanding Lawler rule. You cannot award a contingency fee to a terminated lawyer, and the Supreme Court's reaffirmance of that longstanding rule in this case 1 year ago. Thank you.
Thank you.
There is absolutely zero evidence of any impasse in the settlement negotiations in this case. And when I said, and when Mr. Brownson, the trustee, said that at some point it became a matter of negotiating a number, like an auto case, that's the way all cases are. But their argument is contrary to the district court's finding that prior to our final termination, the stage was set. We originated, developed, and successfully deployed the claim strategy that resulted in the home recovery. What they're suggesting here, that they can come up with some sort of a last-minute rationalization of a firing weeks before the termination, is contrary to the Supreme Court decision in this case and the Supreme Court's policy finding that contingency fees cannot be reduced by firing your lawyer at the last minute when a settlement is on the horizon, or when around here when you're really on the brink of settlement.
As I understand it, didn't appeal the findings of fact as clearly erroneous.
As to ours, we did. Yes, as to the number of hours, we challenge that as being clearly erroneous, because the court itself found, well, it's interesting. The court, it's really a legal issue, because the court found, well, I'm not going to consider these thousands of hours and years of working full time, even though that's when you fully developed the case against the home liquidator. I'm not going to consider it. Well, the Supreme Court said you should consider the hours that go into the case, and those hours were hours that fully developed the case against the home litigator, so they should have been considered as a matter of law.
Well, you didn't, as Mr. Weinberg said, put in new evidence when it went back on remand. You relied on the record.
Absolutely, because the record is very good for us, especially considering the Supreme Court's decision that you cannot reduce a contingency fee when a settlement, it's apparent that there's going to be a settlement or recovery in the case. And that's all in the record. There's no need for an expert. An expert would only give a legal conclusion, and the Supreme Court found that there was no need for an expert. The arguments of the respondent here and some of the and contained in the order below are contrary to the fact that this is an objective test. You look at the time, you look at whether there's going to be a settlement or recovery, Here, it's clear that that was going to happen, and they fired us. You take that from the, that is, intent is inferred. It's obvious. It's the kind of thing, if you talk to someone on the street and just tell them, it's intuitive. At the very last minute, they fire the contingency fee lawyer. It's a great way to save a few million dollars. Well, the Minnesota Supreme Court says, no, you can't do that. It's that simple. And they say, they still are arguing today, yes, we can. And it's for them, this is just a one-off. They can save money, pay contingency fees to the lawyers who submit forms to the trust on behalf of asbestos claimants. But here, we funded this trust with insurance money. That's what we do. We've recovered billions of dollars from insurance companies for asbestos victims. And I've received, our firm has received over $7 million in contingency fees already from this trust. How could anyone say that there's, you know, we had a showing that we've been paid tens of millions of dollars in contingency fees in the very sort of cases that this is on a theory that we developed, implemented, and deployed. We are deserving of our fee, and even more so than just my firm and me. This is about the preservation of the contingency fee. If some subjective idea that somebody may have been dissatisfied in 2011 but didn't fire me, if they were so dissatisfied, why didn't they fire me then? That would be the death knell to the contingency fee. It creates a perverse incentive to fire lawyers at the last minute, and it's wrong. Lawyers should not treat other lawyers that way. This was a lawyer, a trustee. He's the client. He's not a third party. It's not like there are two firms working on this case and you're dividing it that way. They would poison the attorney-client relationship if a client could come in, write a few letters, and we did not spend 10 hours in this case. We never said that we did. That's a reference to time that the trustee spent on the letters.
Thank you. The case is submitted. We'll have our decision out within
90 days. Thank you, Your Honor.